behind this is I want to do a sort of calculation on the board, and I don't want you to be spending all your time just copying it down and checking you've got the right indices, right? I want you to, the purpose of this is to sort of see how it's done. So I want to go through it, you know, it in sort of real time. So, you know, leave yourself space for copying out the relevant lines. You can sort of fill in the notes, but don't sort of spend your time writing down the formulae, because it's not the best use of your time during the lecture. The purpose is for you to see how these things go in practice. Okay, so what we're going to derive is the Kaluza-Klein decomposition of a five-dimensional metric into a four-dimensional metric plus extra fields. So this was thought up 90 years ago. I mean, to be quite honest, I'm not really sure what was going through their minds when they thought about adding an extra dimension, because in 1920 this must have just been a very weird thing to do. But I guess maybe they were just sort of playing around and saying, what if? But the idea is that they add an extra dimension to general relativity. They look at general relativity in five dimensions, and then they find that if we kind of ignore the fifth dimension in the sense of assume that nothing depends on it from the perspective of the geometry, then what you get looks like four-dimensional gravity with electromagnetism. It's not quite, as we'll see, but it was that's not true, because of course Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism back in the 1860s. But it's our modern idea of trying to unify different forces of nature. So what we do is we start in five dimensions, and we write down the metric in a sort of general way. We're going to write down a four-dimensional part, and then we're going to add another dimension. So all I've done is written the different parts in a suggestive way. So we've got, here's our fifth dimension, psi, and g psi is e to the 2 sigma. I've got a cross term, sort of the d psi dx mu piece from here. This is going to be g psi mu, and then my four-dimensional part is split into g mu nu and an a nu part. So it's written this way essentially to make it easy to invert, and in this form if I call that g0, is that g0 times e to the 2 sigma. So fairly obviously what I'm doing here is mu and nu are going to be 0, 1, 2, 3, and a and b, well, actually in the end a and b are also going to be 0, 1, 2, 3. But they're going to be orthonormal indices. And although I won't need to write it down, in this particular instance, I might write m and n for the 5D indices. if I need them. So the plan is that we're going to take the five-dimensional Einstein action, so the Ricci scalar times root G5, and break it up according to these four-dimensional pieces. So d psi is a killing vector here. So that's the rules of the game. That's what we're starting with. So we pick an orthonormal basis because we want to compute the Ricci scalar. So we're going to do this Cartan formalism. So we pick an orthonormal basis. Our omega A is going to be some orthonormal basis for G naught. And then I'm going to define my omega psi is going to be e to the sigma d psi plus a mu dx mu. So that's really d psi plus a, one form. And so I'm just going to go through the steps for computing the curvature. So this is what you've got in front of you. Okay, so just make sure that you follow steps rather than looking for indices. So if I now take my exterior derivatives, so I take d of omega a, so this e, nothing here depends on the psi coordinate, so when I take d of omega a, I'm just going to end up taking the derivatives of this Feuerbein, and that is just the connection in the four-dimensional metric G naught. Now if I look at d of omega psi hat, I'm obviously going to get a sigma, derivative of sigma, times omega psi itself, but then I've got to take d of what's inside the square bracket, and I potentially get a non-zero term here, which is just f, where f is dA. So if I now try and construct my connection one forms, and I start with this one. So d omega psi, remember, this has to equal minus theta psi a cross omega a. So this means that I can just read off this first term there, sort of fairly obvious. Then for the second term, just make sure I get the indices right here. For the second term, I use the fact that the two form f is a half fab omega a wedge omega b. So that gives me this explicitly here. So there was a reason I did that one first. This one's obvious because I have to get this. So I read this off directly. Now I look for theta AB. Well, obviously I've got a theta naught AB here. But I can't just stop there. Normally, you just read these off very easily. If I were to stop there, then I would say my d omega a is, of course, equal to theta minus theta ab cross omega b minus theta a psi cross omega psi. So if I look here and take the wedge product of this with omega psi, you can see that I'm going to get an F term. So I'm going to get an additional term here, which is not compensated here. So I have to add something on to that. So if I add an F omega psi term, that will cancel off the contribution that I would have got from this cross term in the Cartan formula. So both of the connection one forms have an FAB in them. So this shouldn't be a huge surprise, because remember that if I just looked at the four-dimensional indices of the five-dimensional metric, it did have an A mu, A nu in it. So if you were doing this the hard way by sort of writing down the sort of standard formulae for gamma, you would have seen this crop up anyway. So now I've got to go and calculate the curvature forms. So I'm just going to, over here, I'll copy down what these things are, because it's probably useful to have them. Okay, so first of all, let's do the exterior differentiation of this thing here. So it's all written down, so you can see it. So I've got to take d theta naught AB. Then I've got to take the derivative of the other term. Okay, so that's just having taken in turn the derivative of each of these three parts. Now I've got to take my cross terms. And then finally, I've got to take the psi A one form. Now, to get the indices the other way around, I get one minus sign from lowering the psi, another minus sign from swapping the A and B, and then once I raise the A index, I just will raise it with eta AB. So that means I have to just simply raise this A index That's C, isn't it? Not A. Sweet. Oh, what is it? It is the A index. No, it should be. What am I doing? I've flicked down. Wait a minute. It's psi A. Yes, I've flicked from one line to the next. Thanks. That's what I've done. That's it. There we go. Okie doke. So that's sort of, that's having written it down in its full detail. Now we've got to sort of pull the pieces together. And you can see that you've got a d theta naught plus theta naught wedge theta naught, which is simply going to give you the curvature of g naught. So we've got, we sort of pulled together the pieces dependent on G naught only. Then what we want to do is to try and pull together other terms that look similar. So which order have I done it in here? I've pulled together pieces with just F times F. So I've got an F times F here, but it's omega psi cross omega psi. So that gives me nothing. I've got an F times F there. So here, that's actually going to give me a non-zero result. And then if I look at the bottom, I've also got two Fs coming from this term crossed with that term. So if I put those together, make sure. So the first one, I said, was this one, which was FAB times F. And then the second term is this bottom one here, which is FAC, FBD. So that's my pulling together the pieces which just look like FF. Now, if I look at pieces which have just derivatives of sigma in them, then look. So here I've got an FAB sigma comma C, then with omega C cross omega psi. I've got here another FAB sigma comma C. There's the second one. Then I've got to go to the bottom line. So here I've got these cross terms coming from this multiplication here. So that gives me, if I look at the omega C cross omega psi pieces, I've got an FAC sigma comma B. And then here I've got a sigma comma A and an FBD, but I've got to reverse the order. So that's sigma comma A, FBC, omega C cross omega psi. So hopefully that will agree what I've written down. Yep. And then the final term is things with derivatives of F. So here we've got that one. So what have I missed out? So then I've missed out things with thetas and Fs. So Now, do I need to put any minus signs there? Yep, in this one. Okay, so what I've now I've got every single part translated from the first board onto the second board, but what I've done is I've grouped them together in things that look very similar. So you can see, in the end, when we want to get the Ricci scalar, all we're really going to want from this is this very first line, because the very first line is got just four-dimensional indices. Come on. Well, let me check. Where did it come from? Well, if I look at it coming from here, right, the bottom one, FAC, FBD, that's going to give me a quarter e to the 2 sigma. And if I look at it here, this F is a half. So, yes, the quarter is right, I guess. So, sorry? No, but there's two different terms there, right? So when you look at the square of F, I mean the bottom line is giving you this term, and the second line is giving you that term. So it's the quarter should definitely be there. So you need to just amend my handwritten notes then. So, because the handwritten notes are not consistent with what I peel off anyway. So, yeah, no, it is definitely a quarter. Okay, so as I've shown in the notes, this last term is actually, if I look at df, which I know has to vanish, but I look at it in terms of its components, then if I just take the derivative of my 2 form, and then you're going to have to rearrange some indices, but you will see that the fact that this has to vanish tells you that this combination here is actually 0, because df is 0. And so what you're left with is just the top two lines for RAB. So that means that I can read off what my Riemann term is, the one that I want. So I simply take my R0 ABCD from the first term, and then I've got plus a half e to the 2 sigma. And then I have to actually, strictly speaking, to get it right, notice that this is anti-symmetric naturally on C and D, but it's not clear whether this second term is. So I must make sure that when I peel off my components of the Riemann tensor, I make them anti-symmetric in C and D. So hence this explicit anti-symmetrization there. So that's derived for me RABCD. because if the definition of RAB, like any two form, is a half components omega C cross omega D. So I simply, this is all, you know, this, so it's a half times that half times all the junk that's inside the bracket. So that was why the quarter should have been there in the first place. So now I'm just going to do the same thing for the other two form. So I've got to take D of this thing, which is a little longer than the other one. So here I've got sigma AB, omega B cross omega psi, plus then I want sigma A into D of omega psi. So I'm going to have to nip back and check what that is. That's the first term, D of the first term. Okay, so I've taken now the exterior derivative of the second term, three parts again, taking the derivative of sigma, take the derivative of F, take the derivative of the basis element. Then I've got to look at my cross term. So I'm simply multiplying these two pieces together. Okay, and so like before, I'm just going to group everything together. So first of all, if I just look for these DF terms, you can see that I've got, there's an FAB comma C, here I've got an FAB theta naught, and then when I take this cross term here, this F with that theta naught, I get the third. I've got my final part of df. So those three terms are not going to give me anything. So I'm just going to ignore them. And I'm going to try and single out on the top line everything that looks like a cross term with a space normal 4D index and the fifth dimension. So if I pan through there, I've picked up the terms in the top line, and so only the bottom line now is going to contribute, sigma comma B. Let me change the ordering. Okay, so I've just relabeled my indices there. So you can see the way I've written it, the top line is simply the second covariant derivative of sigma plus sigma from A, sigma from B. The second line is F squared. And then, of course, my other non-zero terms, which have to be there because they're there in the RA, you know, the RAB, are the cross terms here. So I've got a e to the sigma, sigma comma AF, plus a half, let me see, FAB, sigma comma C, omega B cross omega C. And then from the bottom line, do I have anything from the bottom line? I don't think so. Right, so from the bottom line, I've got omega psi cross omega psi, which is zero. I've got theta naught cross sigma comma B, which I've put on the top line. Then I've got F cross theta naught, which is contributed to DF, which is therefore zero. And I've already picked up my FF term. So this is everything, or should be. Okay, so from that, I can peel off my R psi A psi B, which is just grad A grad B of sigma plus sigma comma A sigma comma B with a minus sign. So let's hope those signs are actually right. Yep. Okay, so now I've actually got all the relevant parts of the Riemann tensor in relatively short time frame. So I can read off what R5 5 is just by taking eta AB contracted with that. And my RAB is just the Ricci scalar of the background. And then I've got to sum over A and C here. And I've also got to not forget this one over here. Oh, sorry. I was just looking. I was just cross-checking, making sure that this sort of putting my BDI over it, making sure that it was actually right, yeah?
So the covariant derivatives, where do we...
The covariant derivatives are constructed because you've got this theta naught here. So here you've got sigma comma AB, and here you've got minus theta naught sigma comma B. So remember, this thing here, right, was just gamma naught BAC omega C, right? So when you now look at this, you've got a second derivative of sigma minus the first derivative with a gamma. And so that is the covariant derivative expressed in the orthonormal basis, okay? But of course, once you've written some, it's a covariant derivative, therefore it's a proper tensor. If you've got it in one basis, you've got it in all. So here I'm still in my orthonormal basis, but the way I'm writing it down is telling you that you can actually go to any basis, because I've not written anything down which is actually, you know, not covariant as a tensor. So now I just simply take the contraction of all this lot, and I've got R naught plus a quarter F squared, and then I've got minus 2 sigma minus 2 grad sigma squared. And you sort of, I rewrote this in the notes as something involving a derivative of e to the sigma.
A question about the sign on this third line of the formula, the sign of the plus 1/2, because it doesn't, it's not coherent with the one.
Is that right?
I think it's minus 1.
Well, let me see. Of course, it's really up for grabs, isn't it? With these notes. So let me find out. Right. Trouble is, I've just gone and scrubbed off where I took it from. Have I swapped an ordering of the cross terms, do you think, without realizing I've done it, and I've been going from one board to the next? Trouble is, I can't see it from the notes. So that came from, where did it come from?
It came from the third line of the page 7.
Yeah, but I think what I've done.
Where?
Yeah, that. So that was from the cross term, which was. I'm quite happy to just put it as a minus, because the way I've written it out in here is different. If I had that, still had that on the bottom of the board, I'd be able to see immediately what I'd done. And I probably just actually swapped the ordering there. In fact, it's almost certain that I have, because this C here is going with that there. And I think that came from the first, you know, the first bracket and not the second bracket. Sigma comma C. So I have in fact swapped the ordering there without spotting that I've done it. So yes. Okay. It's good. Keep me on my toes. So as I said already, the determinant of G was equal to the determinant of G naught times e to the 2 sigma. So now you see why I've rewritten this here. So once I multiply my R5 by root G5, I've simply got R plus F squared time plus a total derivative. Sorry, why does? Oh, if you just you'll have to sit, you'll have to sort of look and do it as the term. That's just that's why you didn't have any a mu terms in G. You've kind of, because you're peeling off uniformly this. You know, if you write it in a coordinate frame, you're sort of actually trying to complete the square in terms of the 5-5 component and the cross terms. It's just the way it works. So you kind of sort of have to sit down and just see it for yourself, I think. So if I now look at my 5D action, then I now know how to replace that with these fields. So nothing in my action, in my Lagrangian depends on psi, so I can simply integrate out over psi to get giving me a value of L, where L is the length in psi coordinates. And so I end up with my Kalutza-Klein action. And so this is what, obviously, you can see why they were excited, because that looks like Einstein-Maxwell theory. So it's very nearly Einstein-Maxwell. So Einstein-Maxwell would be this action if sigma was just naught. So although when I derived the Einstein-Hilbert action, I did actually comment on what to do if there was a scalar, because we look, you know, I mentioned about Brands-Dickey theory. It's actually conventional not to work in a frame with a scalar, but to actually get rid of it and go to what's called the Einstein frame. And we do this by making what's known as a conformal transformation. So a conformal transformation is when you multiply the metric by a function. So it's called conformal because what it's doing is it's preserving angles. And so if you think about it, normally you would define an angle as cos theta was equal to u dot v over mod u mod v. So you have to be a little cautious, because we know we can have null vectors in a Lorentzian metric. But you see here that u dot v is essentially just g mu nu u mu v nu. And of course, mod u is just taking the same thing with just G. So if I rescale my metric, I don't do anything to angles. So that's why that's called a conformal transformation. So under one of these transformations, as you showed yesterday, this, I find that R naught has a fairly straightforward form. It just goes, you get some inverse powers of your conformal factor and some derivatives of your conformal factor. So if I now look at what I want to do is to choose omega so that this transforms into root gr. So the determinant of g naught becomes omega to the eighth determinant of g. So I get an omega to the fourth root g there. Still got my e to the sigma. And then I've got r naught, which is omega to the minus 2, r minus 6, omega inverse box, omega. So looking at this, that tells me I want omega squared to be e to the minus sigma. So I take omega to be e to the minus sigma on 2. If I do that, I've ensured that I've got root gr. So in this case, my r naught becomes omega to the minus 2 is e to the sigma. And then I've got to subtract off this term. Sorry, e to the plus. So I have to take my derivative of my conformal factor. So here I've got plus 3 e to the sigma box sigma. And then I've got minus 3 halves e to the sigma grad sigma squared. So now I just pull this all together. Okay, so putting it all together, I've got my root gr. So I multiply, you're basically taking e to the minus sigma through this. Root gr, I've got a total derivative. Then I've got a kinetic term for my scalar field. This was the reason for writing. Now, hang on, have I got my things mixed up there? If sigma is root, I think I mean it the other way around, don't I? I think I mean phi is root 3. Sigma. Yep. Yes. So if I write phi as root 3 sigma, I've now got a conventionally normalized kinetic term, a half grad phi squared. So this is the standard Kaluza-Klein action. So let me just fit, yeah?
Sorry, break the box sigma.
Because it's a total derivative. So I'm just ignoring it. Yeah, I mean, it's not going to give me any dynamics in the interior. So I'm not worrying about boundary terms in this particular context. So let me just finish off by looking or talking about black holes. We've already actually written down a black hole in Kaluza-Klein in the sense that nothing can depend on the extra dimension. So if we have a horizon, it's actually got to extend in the extra dimension. So the black string we wrote down is a Kaluza-Klein black hole. So So you'll see that I'm using the phrase black hole in a rather generic term to simply represent anything with an event horizon, no matter whether it's spherical, cylindrical, wobbly, a ring, or whatever. So the first thing, I'll just do electric black holes and then stop. But the first thing to notice is that when you normally you think about when you see a space-time where you've got nothing depending on a direction, you imagine that you can do a Lorentz boost, okay? So if we make a boost in our fifth direction, we're actually going to break, in some sense, this symmetry. It actually corresponds to something physical. So here's my psi direction. And what I'm doing when I take a Kaluza-Klein identification is I'm actually identifying psi with psi plus L. And the subtext is that it's at constant t. So if I do a Lorentz boost, and I sort of change my axes to t prime and psi prime, then obviously this point and this point are no longer at the constant t prime. So it is not true that psi prime is identified with psi prime plus L or even psi prime plus gamma L or gamma inverse L or whatever. And the reason is that we are identifying at different t prime. And so what this means is that if we make a boost before identifying, typically we're going to have a different space-time. So if we have a space-time which is initially looks like it's invariant in that extra dimension, we make a boost, it's going to change. So remember that the cross terms in the metric, psi mu cross terms, were the gauge field. So what this means is, if you do a boost, what you're doing is you're actually changing, if you write down the metric, you're potentially including cross terms between t prime and psi prime. And so that means you're potentially including an A naught. And so A naught is what you would associate with charge. So let's look at what happens. The black string. Okay, so all I've done here is made a boost, and then I've identified. So So now if I just pull together the various terms, so I've written now, grouped together the T and psi terms in the same form as I originally wrote down so that I can read off my gauge field. So what you see is that the gauge field is just Q over R. So that's exactly what you would expect for something with an electric charge. So I'll just, for completeness, I'll write down what the four metric is, the G mu nu. So you'll notice, actually, this has some similarities with some of the stringy metrics I wrote down yesterday, in that you've got two Schwarzschild-type potentials when your charge, and one of them is dependent on the charge. And in this case, the extremal limit, remember Rice and Nordstrom, the extremal limit is when Q goes to M. In this case, to get an extremal limit, we actually take V to 1, and at the same time, M goes to 0. So what we're doing is we're taking our string, our part, it's like thinking of a particle, going to the speed of light. In order to do that, I've got to send its mass to zero. Only massless particles can travel on null geodesics. And so the extremal metric is sort of like that of a massless particle traveling at the speed of light round the extra dimension. So you'll sort of see this type of construction crops up sort of again and again in string theory solutions. So I'll stop there. Tomorrow I just want to comment on the magnetic Kaluza-Klein solution, and then we'll move on to the other way of hiding extra dimensions, which is brainwaves.